Am I on? Oh, there we are. Before we get started on this week's lesson, I just want to give you a word about next week's lesson. The homework may be a little longer than it has been before, so just be patient. It's just 1 week. It's a tough week. It's a lot to get through, and so I just want you to know that's coming. Maybe give yourself a little more time. Understand that you're going to be covering some things that you're going to have like no historical context for, no cultural context for. I'll give you some of that in the homework, but really in the teaching next week is where that's all going to kind of get sorted out. So if you put in the work, if there's a week that I really want you to do, I always want you to do the homework, but if there's a week I'd really like you to, it's next week because there'll be a lot of ground to cover and it'll help you to have a head start on things if you have already done that. So there you go. Our job tonight is to finish out the Ten Commandments. We started last week. We covered the first four, and as I had told you, and you may have noticed that when we looked at how Jesus summarized the law and the prophets in the New Testament, it was love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. And so we said that last week we looked at that vertical relationship in the first four commands. It was how do we love the Lord our God? And so this week with the next six, we're going to look at how do we love our neighbor as ourself. The way that you should be thinking about the Ten Commandments, their placement in the story of the Exodus, think of it as God saying to this newly created nation, let there be light. This is him speaking light into their spiritual darkness and saying, this is the way, walk in it. And so this is the equivalent, the moral equivalent of God saying, let there be light. He is creating a community of people that will have shared values. We understand the need for this at an elementary level, literally at an elementary level. If you got into a kindergarten class on the first day of school, what do you think that teacher would be covering? Let's talk about the class rules, right? Because in order for us to all live well with each other, we have to have some boundaries on what's going to happen. Otherwise, we will be in big trouble. And so we talked about last week how the Ten Commandments are rules that are given not to restrict us and beat us into submission. They are rules that are given to enable us to fully enjoy the privilege we have been given as the chosen people of God. They make life better. They don't make it worse. They make it better. And so we want to pay close attention to what they're saying to us. Now, the first commandment that we pick up with this week is honor your father and your mother. And I said in your homework that it acted as a bridge between what we looked at last week and what we were going to look at this week. Why? Because it talks about honor, which is exactly what was implied in all of those first four commands. The first command, that's you shall have no other gods before me, you could read it as honor me as God alone. The second command, don't make a carved image, honor me without limitation or reduction. We talked last week about how carving an image of God was a way to make him smaller. It was a way to have power over him. The third command, don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain, could be read as honor my character in all that you say and do. And then remember the Sabbath day, honor me as your creator and sustainer. So we've already had this topic of honor introduced, but we haven't had it explicitly stated in the command until now. Honor your father and your mother. And I had you look that up. You're supposed to write a definition for honor. Did anybody else look in the dictionary and come up with salute with a bow in square dancing? I was like, okay, I hope we can all not write that as our definition. So that is, we're not talking about square dancing tonight. We're talking about esteeming and respecting. And so the reason that the fifth command to honor your father and your mother acts as a bridge is because we're now moving from honoring our heavenly authority to moving to honoring those who are in authority over us on this earth. Before we look at these last six commandments, I want to take you very quickly to the New Testament. We're going to look at Luke chapter 10. If we didn't have so much to cover tonight, I would love to spend a lot of time here. But since I barely got through four commands last week and I have six this week, I'm not going to do that. Luke chapter 10, this is probably a familiar story to you. It's important for us to understand what we're going to be talking about tonight because, as I said, last week we talked about how do we honor God. This week we are going to talk about how do we honor our neighbor, okay? How do we honor our neighbor? And so this story is going to talk a lot about how we should be reading these commands. So Luke chapter 10, starting in verse 25. says, "And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him, Jesus, to the test, saying, 'Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?' Jesus said to him," now listen to what Jesus says, "'What is written in the law? How do you read it?'" Okay, there's something interesting here to note, because Jesus assumes that this man knows the law and has an interpretation of the law. Women in Bible study, he assumes the same thing about you. What is in the law? How do you read it? And that's why we're here, so that we will have an interpretation. Okay, and then the man answers in 27. "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus said to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this and you will live." So this guy, he gets to ask his big question of Jesus. Jesus asks him what he thinks the answer is. He gives the answer and Jesus says, "You're right." He's having a good day. Some of these interactions don't go as well, but he doesn't know how to quit when he's ahead, because look what he says next in verse 29. "But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, 'And who is my neighbor?'" Did you hear that? Because in Jewish thinking, your neighbor was someone who was another Jew. So he's saying, did you catch it? So how far do I have to go with this? How much do I have to do with this law? Do you hear the line walker mentality there? What's the bare minimum I can do to fulfill this and have righteousness? And so Jesus, in response, tells a story that you're familiar with about a man who is beaten and left for dead on the road to Jericho. He would probably be on the road to Jericho because he was Jewish, okay? And so then he's passed by two of the Jewish culture's elite. They don't go over and touch him. And then the third person who comes by is an outcast. He's a half-breed. So if anyone did not owe neighborly behavior to this man lying in the gutter, it is the third man, the Samaritan, but he in fact comes over, and does he do the bare minimum? No, he goes above and beyond to see that the man gets help. So before we look at what happens next, what was the question that the lawyer asked back in verse 29? He said, "And who is my what? Neighbor." So let's see if Jesus answered that question. Go down to verse 36. "Which of these three," Jesus says, "do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?" Did you notice what happened? Jesus doesn't say who this man has to be a neighbor to. He says, which of these men was a good neighbor? He doesn't answer. He makes it a bigger thing. Rather than say, who do I have to show favor to? He says, who was the one who showed favor? Look at your motives. And the man begrudgingly says, the one who showed him mercy. Did you notice he doesn't say Samaritan? He won't even say it because it's such a dirty word to him, and he knows he's been led into a trap. And Jesus said to him, "You go and do likewise." You go and do likewise. I hope that none of us in here has the heart of the Pharisee. I hope that none of us read through these six commands of how to honor our neighbor this week and thought, well, what's the least I can do to get away with them? And tonight what we're going to do is we're going to go through them asking the question, how can I be a neighbor? How can I look for opportunities to be a neighbor, rather than say, where is the line where I can stop feeling like I have to offer neighborliness to those around me? So let's flip back now to Exodus chapter 20, and we will pick up in verse 12. Exodus 20, verse 12, the fifth command, "Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you." Anybody ever had their parents quote this one at them when they were being bad? Yeah, I mean, I remember my mom in a moment of frustration saying, "Do you want to live a long time? Well, you better honor me." And I always thought, that's weird. Why is the promise that is attached to this one that your days would be long upon the land? And so it was interesting this week as I was preparing, one of the things that was pointed out is you have to really consider who is the audience for the Ten Commandments. Did you notice who the audience is? You know what the rest of them are. There's don't commit adultery. There's don't commit murder, right? Don't lie. Don't covet your neighbor's wife, manservant, maidservant. So what segment of the population is listening to these commands being read aloud? Is it children? No. The Ten Commandments are addressed to an adult audience. And that changes the way that we read the primary interpretation of the fifth command. Hey, grown-ups, honor your aging father and mother if you yourself would like to grow to an old age. That make a lot more sense? honor your aging father and mother. It's hard to honor an aging father and mother. Why? Because we grow up and we know it all. And we get old enough to where we don't see our parents as superheroes anymore. Some of us are able to hold on to that longer than others, depending on whether you had parents who were great parents or parents who maybe made mistakes along the way that you were aware of. And so we get to a certain age and we begin to lose our tolerance for being around them. Most of you, if I said, hey, would you like to move back home and live with your parents for an extended period of time? How would you feel? You probably would not love that. I think they make TV shows about people who do that and it doesn't go well. So the point here is that as your parents are getting older, it is your responsibility to show honor to them. I mean, in this historical context, it would have meant you need to provide for them. It wasn't as though there were places that they could go and live. They came and lived with you and you supported them financially for as long as you had the honor and privilege of having them in your home. And so this is saying, take care, notice, we say we're going to talk about honoring our neighbors, right? Take care of the neighbors who are the closest to you, the neighbors that are in your own family. If you are going to honor your neighbor, the place where honoring neighbors begins is within your home. Jeff and I teach a parenting class, and the whole premise of the class sort of revolves around this idea that if we are to have any concept of what true community looks like, it has to start in our homes. We have to have mutual respect for each other. It has to be an environment where we have agreed upon rules, all of these things. And I think that's what we see here in this command. It's if we don't start in the home with giving respect to those to whom respect is due, then being able to do it outside of our homes is not going to be a very likely supposition. So we honor our heavenly authority, and now we see that we are called to honor our earthly authority, our parents, even unto age. So the question then comes up, it always comes up, what if my parents are not worthy of honor? I know that in this room there are any number of you who have parents who have either harmed you or neglected you. Not all earthly parents are like our heavenly parent, some of them not in any form at all. And so how are we supposed to show honor to a parent who doesn't deserve it? I don't know your situation, and so I think that that's something you really have to ask the Lord for wisdom on. Depending on the amount of difficulty that you went through with your parents, it may be that for you to show honor to a parent means that you look to who the Lord did place in your life as a parent figure to you. Who did the Lord place in your life? Who was an authority figure? Who poured into you? Show honor to them. And when it comes to your own parents, maybe the way that you show honor is just by being silent. That might be it. You know, if you had a parent who just drove you crazy and made a few mistakes, I would say first, have some children of your own and you might find some grace for them. I saw on Pinterest this week someone, not Pinterest, I'm not even on Pinterest, on Facebook, not that there's anything wrong with that. On Facebook, someone had posted one of those e-cards and it said, behind every happy, successful child is a mom who's pretty sure she's screwing it up. I think that's the way that we feel. Isn't that the way that we always feel? And so I know that for me, having my own children made me look at my own parents and say, they did the best they could. They didn't wake up in the morning and think of ways to screw up our family, you know? They did the best that they could. So some of honoring is just recognizing that we're all working with the tools that we have. In most circumstances, parents do not set out to harm their children when they get up in the morning. You know your circumstance. Ask the Lord to give you wisdom. Rather than say, what is the bare minimum I can do to show honor to these parents? Ask him, how can I broaden that? What are the ways that I can go out of my way to show them honor, whether they deserve it or not? You know, we've talked about this before with political figures. It's hard for us to show honor sometimes to an elected official who we didn't vote for, but the Bible calls us to anyway. I think the same can be said of our earthly parents. Even if you don't agree with what they did, even if you suffered harm at their hands, there is some way that you can either in your silence or in your words, in your withholding action or in doing action, show honor to them just because the Lord chose them to be your parents. There was something either in your circumstances, there was something that the Lord intended for your good, even if the way was painful. Okay, so with keeping the fifth command, we should honor our parents as long, and bear in mind, as long as by doing so we are honoring God. because there has been some misuse of this command by parents who are not good parents to say, you have to do whatever I say because I am your parent. That is not true. Just as is the case with any other earthly authority, if what a parent requires of a child is not in line with what the Lord would have for us, we're not obligated to do it. We're not. So, a difficult command, honor your mother and your father, that your days may be long in the land. For those of us who have good relationships with our parents, we can look for words of affirmation. We can be guarded. One of the things I think that's really important is, you know, I don't know if you've noticed, I have kids who, you know, who have, my parents are their grandparents now. And just by allowing my children to form their own perception of my parents without me coloring it with whatever baggage I'm carrying around from my childhood. And honestly, I'll just say I had great parents. But you know how it is. You have something that you remember that was just so painful or whatever. And just not telling my children those things, allowing them to have that relationship with my parents free of any of my own baggage is one of the ways that I've really tried to honor my parents. And honestly, I learned that technique from my parents. My parents got divorced when I was young, and they honored each other even in their divorce. So I had that modeled for me, that they allowed me to preserve relationship with both of them just by what they didn't say or what they did say. So it was a valuable lesson. I think we can apply that here with the fifth command. Okay, so moving on, because we have six of these to get through. The next one, number six, you shall not murder. And this is that one where you're like, okay, I think I'm going to get an 80 on this test because I don't murder and I haven't committed adultery. So I'm going to get an 80 and that's a B, right? Okay, so that was what was so funny. When Matt was little, my oldest, he came home from school. It was like, he must have been in the second grade, and they just started giving letter grades, and so he didn't even know what that meant, you know. And he brings something home, and he had a 60 on it, and I pulled it out, and I was like, honey, you got a 60 on this. And he's like, what? It was a spelling test. A 60? And I said, yeah. And he's like, yeah, Mom, that's pretty good. You know, out of 100, I got 60 of them right. And I said, honey, that's a D. You got a D on your spelling test. And he goes, well, yeah, but Mom, I didn't get an E or an F. No concept of the grading scale. And I think that's the way that we can be sometimes. We look at the Ten Commandments and we think, I think I can pull off about 80% of these. But the Lord says, no, 100% obedience is what I require. And that's why we need Christ. And we have him, thanks be to God. Okay, so you shall not murder. I was laughing thinking, I wonder if the groups that are in here sharing, you know, we had everybody in this room tonight, and I was hoping no one was going to, like, confess to murder in the middle of their small group. I don't think that happened. So what do we say? What's the lie that we tell ourselves about you shall not murder? I mean, when I had you go and look at the Sermon on the Mount, it kind of clears it up. The lie that we tell ourselves is that as long as we have not physically murdered someone, we have loved our neighbor as ourselves. Right? I have honored my neighbor as long as I have not gone over there and murdered him for not trimming the shrubs that he has not trimmed in forever. But we saw in the Sermon on the Mount that the sin of murder is linked to the sins of anger and contempt, specifically linked to sins of the mouth. And so we all know that there have been times that while we may not have actually physically committed a murder, we have murdered a person's character with our words. And the point with the Sermon on the Mount is not that anger and contempt are the same thing as murder. The point is that they are the first steps down the road toward a murderous act. And so for the people of God who are not saying, how close can I get to the line without crossing it? To the people of God who are saying, I'm going to flee from sin, we begin fleeing from sin by dealing with its root, and those roots are anger and contempt. So just because you have not stuck a knife into someone does not mean that you have successfully navigated the sixth command. In fact, Luther, Calvin, and Aquinas all taught that we become murderers when we fail to recognize the plight of others. When we don't look around us and actively seek ways to come to the aid of others, we are not obeying the command, the spirit of this command. I thought that was very interesting. It reminded me of that Martin Luther King quote. He says, in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. What if our sin of omission is, in effect, murder? What if we don't stand up for what is right when we need to, and we allow someone else's character to fall, or we allow someone else to be marginalized or maligned or made less of? So sometimes honoring our neighbor in this way means that we hold our tongue if someone else is, you know, getting into it. Sometimes it means that we speak up and defend them. So keeping the sixth command, rather than say, how can I avoid physically murdering someone, we begin to change the way that we think about it. We talk about, how am I a life giver? How do I value, nurture, and protect life? It's not simply a matter of not killing someone. Honor your neighbor's life is at the root of this command. How am I a life giver with my words? Do I avoid reckless talk? You know, you don't want to commit the involuntary manslaughter equivalent of verbally harming someone just because you were careless in the way that you talked about them or talked about them to someone else who was going to be careless. So I pointed out in the homework, or had you point out, that we're not necessarily talking about all forms of killing here. But we're certainly talking about intentional killing, but we are also talking about the kind of killing that happens, you know, either by accident because you weren't being careful, or that was the result of you walking towards it. So involuntary and voluntary manslaughter, I think, fall under this whole thing. Were you behaving in a way that was reckless and brought harm on someone else with your words or your actions? I got to tell you, the thing that came into my mind was texting and driving. Because I have a hard time. I think my business is also urgent. Maybe I do need to just check it at that red light. And then I start pulling through the intersection and I'm not done with my transaction on my phone. Am I honoring my neighbor's life when I do that? No. I mean, in my head, saying it to you now, it's crazy. It is craziness. So I think there are a lot of ways we can think about how we can be careful with the lives of others. Literally, and also metaphorically. How are we life givers? Are even the words that we speak words that give life, or are they words that take life away? Okay, moving on to number 7. You shall not commit adultery. This is the one that most of us still get an 80 on because we haven't actually gone out and committed adultery. Now, the honor idea behind you shall not commit adultery is honor your neighbor's marriage. Or you could say, honor your neighbor's most intimate relationships, okay? So you're going to say, you have your relationship, it is where it needs to be, I have mine. So in honoring your neighbor's marriage, you also end up honoring your own. And in your homework, you saw that the reason that not committing adultery was so important is because it's a picture of Christ's relationship with the church. But when we hear this, you shall not commit adultery, we tend to reduce this just to, oh, this is about sex. This is just about sex, but there's so much more to it. And women, I think, recognize this sometimes more than men do, because if we're honest with ourselves, we know that we get dragged into lustful thinking of a whole different kind than men get approached with. You know, you saw in the Sermon on the Mount how Jesus said, if a man even looks at a woman with lustful intent, he has committed adultery in his heart. Once again, it doesn't mean that looking at a woman with lustful intent is the same thing as adultery. It's not. He's pointing you back and saying, if you want to flee from sin, chop it off at the root. And so what is our root sin here? What is the thing that stirs up our desire for something other than the person that the Lord has given us to be married to? We have these desires for approval and attention. We have a desire to be desired. We have a desire to escape. Sometimes that manifests itself in the movies we watch and the books we read. It can be anything. We have a desire to be courted. Some of us think that what marriage looks like in the months leading up to it is what marriage should look like for the whole span of our marriage, and we spend our whole marriage trying to get that poor man to bring his A game like he did before we actually got married. And we're so convinced that there's someone out there who could do that for us. And so we meet someone at work, or we meet someone somewhere where we go regularly, at the gym, whatever it is, and he's bringing his courtship game. And we think, he wouldn't have quit. He wouldn't have quit when we got married. That's a lie. That's you attaching your desires to something that is not real. Some of us have a desire for a romantic ideal. Valentine's Day is coming up. How hard are you going to be on that man? You think about it. Are you holding him up to an ideal? Are you being unfaithful in your thoughts toward him because whatever he comes up with on the 14th isn't going to be enough? And there's someone out there who would have done more. because that Hallmark commercial said it, and that flower commercial said it, and that guy's out there. Or how about this one, the desire for intimacy? We just want someone who understands us. He doesn't understand me. He doesn't understand me. He just sits on the couch and watches TV. He doesn't get me at all. And we think that someone else is going to get us in a way that he doesn't. And rather than invest in that relationship with him, we would rather just wipe the slate and go entertain an idea of someone else, because it just seems easier if we would just start over. But no, we have to honor our neighbor's marriage, and we do that by honoring our own. So you have to ask yourself, rather than saying, how can I keep from going to bed with someone else, which is not always a hard question for all of us, it is for some of us, but we have to ask instead, how can I nurture the relationship that the Lord has given me? How can I be even more faithful to my husband than I already am? What things should I continue to do? What things should I stop doing? What desires should I keep an eye on, the ones we just talked about? How can I spend my time and effort to build this relationship? This is how we keep from committing adultery, by running the other way. A good question also, I think, that we can ask ourselves. When you're around a man who's not your husband, and you're enjoying your interaction with him, which is, listen, let me tell you straight up, I had four brothers, I enjoy friendships with men, I don't have an issue with it. It's not me sitting there thinking, ooh, I'd like to date him. But the thing that I have to remember, because I do have a comfort level around men, is I have to ask this question, is the way I interact with another woman's husband the way I would want his wife to interact with my husband? That's a tough litmus test. And that cuts out a lot of activities that a lot of people would tell you are no big deal. Oh, I think I'll just send him a text. Oh, I think, you know, sure, we can meet for lunch. It's okay if nobody else. There's just a lot of things that change when you view your relationship with a man who's not your husband that way. I think there are applications here for you, whether you are married or single. There's just a lot to be said here for all of our male-female interactions. And again, I am not the person who is going to tell you, women, you should be afraid to be friends with men. I am not that girl. But I will tell you, you have to be smart about it. Because for one thing, just because you're comfortable in a male-female friendship doesn't mean that he is. And he may totally misread the signs if you are not extremely cautious. I hate that it's that way. I think it's a product of the fall myself, and I look forward to heaven being a place where we can just all enjoy each other without all the undercurrents. But we're not there yet, and so we have to be careful. We honor our neighbor's marriage by honoring our own. Okay, next, number 8, you shall not steal. Okay, here's where I have to confess that I steal pens. I steal pens like crazy. I don't even realize that I'm doing it. And so if I come to your desk and you have a pen there and it's not there when I leave, you should probably come ask me if I have it, because I don't even realize it until like 3 weeks later and I'm digging through my purse and I find 15 or 16 pens down in there. And then it's too late. I don't know who they all go to. It's just all of this guilt that I've been carrying around in my purse. You probably have something that is your little thing that you have trouble with. Just something that you maybe, I don't know, maybe you like to steal soaps from bathrooms. I don't know what it is. There's something where you just, you feel like that's really okay. That could be mine. And so I asked you to look this week at the verse that said, he who is faithful with little is also faithful with much. And this is, I know this to be true of myself, that those little things are like a gateway drug. You know, it starts there, and then it's like, well, you know what? Maybe I am entitled. Maybe all the earth is mine and everything in it. And only one person can say that, right? And the reason that we have difficulty with wanting one person's stuff to be theirs and one person's stuff to be theirs and our stuff to be ours is because we don't understand this concept of stewardship. How much of it is ours? None of it. None of it. And the Lord has seen fit to give us what we need. I love that verse in the hymn. All I have needed, your hand has provided. Great is thy faithfulness. And when we steal, we say that that is a lie. I don't have all I need. And and I'm going to go find it because you would want me to have this, right? So I'm just going to go help myself. So when we say you shall not steal, the honor thought behind that is honor your neighbor's belongings. Because if you think about it, we've already talked about stealing. He's already said, don't steal his wife, don't steal his life through murder. And now we're to don't steal his stuff. And actually the next one, don't bear false witness, will be don't steal his reputation. So here we are on stuff. Honor your neighbor's belongings. Understand the principle of stewardship. It is all God's. And so then we change the way that we think about this. It's not just I'm going to keep my hands to myself. I'm not going to engage in stealing. It is instead of what should I not take, it's what can I give? What can I lend without expecting repayment? How can I be open-handed with the things God has given me rather than how can I look for ways outside of God's will to make more of what I have? How can I help someone in need so that they themselves will not want to steal? I have to think we'd have less of a problem with theft if we had less people who had their needs met. So maybe we can be a part of solving that by being open-handed with the things that we have. At the end of the day, stealing is an act of contempt. It says, you are not worth what I am worth, and your stuff should be mine. It degrades the one from whom we steal. If we can steal from someone, we're probably not going to pray for them. Are we? So, each one of you in here knows what your area of difficulty is. Ask yourself, how can I be open-handed? Instead of what can I take, how can I think, what can I give? All right, number 9, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. This was an interesting one because my whole life I was told that this meant you shall not lie. And it's actually something way more specific than that. I'm not saying that the Bible encourages you to lie. I'm just saying that in this command, we are looking at something that deals specifically with how we can honor our neighbor. How can we honor our neighbor's reputation? It's actually talking about, like, within the context of a trial, if you were in legal proceedings with someone, you need to be honest when you talk about what happens. It says literally, do not accuse your neighbor with false testimony. That's literally how it translates. Don't accuse your neighbor with false testimony. So how do we do this? What is our motive? I mean, really, we do this all the time. We just do it in subtle ways outside of a courtroom. We throw in a little jab about someone. Well, you know, she kind of has a problem with controlling her tongue. I'll tell you what. The quickest way to figure out what someone's besetting sin is to listen for the sin that they're pointing out in everybody around them. Because we do it to self-justify, don't we? And that's the whole point of accusing someone falsely, is so that we can elevate self, so that we can justify self, and so that we can protect self. Completely the opposite of love your neighbor as you love yourself. If we truly wanted to obey that command the way that we're supposed to, we would look for ways to make more of them than ourselves, to let our own protection go aside that they might be protected, to stop pointing out their sin and turn our eyes on our own. Honor your neighbor's reputation. Proverbs 25:18 says this. Listen to this. A man or woman, take a little liberty there, a man who bears false witness against his neighbor is like a war club or a sword or a sharp arrow. You shall not murder. Here it is. It's the same idea, only now with our words overtly. And so when we keep the 9th commandment, are we just to not tell lies about other people? Is that it and then we're good? No, we have to go beyond that. We need to steer clear of all speech that harms our neighbor. And not only that, we need to steer clear of people whose speech harms our neighbor. Sometimes we enjoy those people because we feel like, well, they're the one committing the sin, and I didn't really say it. I mean, I laughed, you know, okay, I laughed. Or I was interested. But no, don't have any part with foolish people, and that is foolish behavior. They are looking to gather people around them, and that's what hurting people do. They look to gather around them like-minded people who can buy into their version of the truth, and their version of the truth will always involve making less of someone else so that they can make more of themselves. So it's not just about guarding your own speech. It's about staying away from people whose speech is harmful and destructive of their neighbor. And then we have to ask ourselves this question, where are my relationships being diminished because I'm being less than honest? To whom have I presented a better image of myself than is true? So that they might even feel reproach because they think I'm better than them. Do you see how that too is bearing false witness against your neighbor? Because you've made them to feel less, not by telling them they're less, but by telling them you're more when you're not. So, where in my relationships, where are they being diminished because I'm being less than honest? Honor your neighbor's reputation. Don't bear false witness against your neighbor. And now we come to the last one. You shall not covet. And we're going to pull this one apart just a little bit, but I want you to notice the progression that we've gone through with these commands. So commands 5, 6, 7, and 8 said, don't do something, okay? Did you notice that? They were about our actions. Don't do this. And then command 9 was, don't say this. And what does command 10 do? Don't even think about it. Don't even think about it. We move from what our hands are doing and what our mouth is doing to what's going on in our heart. It is such an appropriate ending to this list. Don't think for a minute that the Lord is only concerned with outward obedience. He cares about the heart. And notice what he says here. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. Now, the first thing I want you to notice about this command is that it describes the person that we are not to covet as a person of some means. He's someone who has oxen and manservants and maidservants and a house. So this is someone he's got a pretty nice life. And look at how it breaks out. It says, don't covet his house. So that's his belongings, basically. And then don't covet his wife, male servant, female servant. So that's his relationships. And then ox, donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's is where we start to realize, oh, this is someone who's more than just a guy with a house. He's got all this other stuff going on too, so don't covet his circumstance. Don't covet your neighbor's stuff, his relationships, or his circumstance. Those three things. Now, if we were to speak of this in the same language that we've used, what are we to honor in this? Honor your neighbor in your heart. And we do this by being content. Being content. You know, I thought for the longest time that when the Bible told us to be content, you know, godliness with contentment is great gain, I thought that's just a lovely recommendation. I'm going to think about that. Here's the problem. It's a command. It's in the top 10 list. That means if I struggle with discontentment, I struggle with sin. Not just with not following God's recommendation. The New Testament in Philippians chapter 4, you know that verse, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me? Tim Tebow, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. It's not a verse about winning the Super Bowl. Before that, he describes how he has learned to be content in all these terrible circumstances. And he says, but I can do all these things. I can be content through Christ who strengthens me. It's a verse about contentment. And he says, contentment is learned. And it can be accomplished. Why? Because what the Lord commands, he also enables his children to fulfill. You are able to learn contentment, but you have to be a student of the things that feed your discontentment. And what are they? We have 1,000 desire-enhancing sources that come into our line of vision on any particular day. Does anybody get catalogs in the mail? Yeah. And what do you do with them? Oh, I put them in the recycle bin. I don't even look at them. No, you don't. You sit down and you flip through and you dog your pages, and the ones that are for kids, you hand to your kids, and you say, you circle what you think you'd like for your birthday. What do you think's going to happen? I know what happens to me. I get the Pottery Barn catalog and All's Right with the World. I get to the end and I'm like, I can't live in this dump of a house for one more second. Right? Maybe you're out on Pinterest. Maybe it's all those home improvement shows. You know what your kryptonite is. You know where you get your desires flamed. You know. What is it? Are you going to cut off this sin at the root? Are you going to? But that we don't even need Pinterest. Like before Pinterest was around, contentment was still a problem because it's all the way back here in the Old Testament. Why? Because the bigger thing that is a problem for us, like I can watch HGTV and say, I don't have money for that. But when my next door neighbor has it, then I get entitled really fast. Well, I think Jim makes about as much money as my husband does. And we have Formica countertops, and why does he have granite? I cannot be happy one more second unless I have granite countertops in my, honey, they have granite at their house. And then all of a sudden, granite is like the leprosy of the kitchen world, and I got to get rid of it as soon as I can. Why? Because I'm so concerned with what's going on next door. There is a French proverb that says that our greatest problem with contentment is the absurd idea we have of the happiness of others. We think they're happy because they have a nicer kitchen than we do. You're laughing now, but you were thinking it this afternoon. And we are willing participants in building the fantasy. We are willing participants in feeding the flames of our desire. And it's a pattern that goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. When Eve looked around at a garden that the Lord had said, it is all for you. But there's one rule. Not 10, one. And she believed that in that one rule, God was withholding something good from her. I want that. Why can't I have that? And that's the way we are with the rules. I'm not happy until I have what I think I need. And I don't care what you think I need. I need this. And so my question for you is, how will you learn contentment? What desire-enhancing sources do you need to cut off at the root so that you can say the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord, so that you can agree with James that every good and perfect gift comes down from heaven above, and that if I don't have it, it wasn't good for me and it wasn't perfect. How can you get there? You're going to have to narrow your vision. You're going to have to stop window shopping and enjoying the possibilities and say, the boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Because godliness with contentment is great gain. And rather than think about what you might like to have, spend some time thinking more about what you might give. So I ask you tonight the same question that Jesus asked of the young lawyer. What is written in the law? How do you read it? And I say to you the same words that he spoke to that same lawyer. Go and do likewise. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, your law is good. It is for our good. It protects us, but it does more than protect us. It opens us up to enjoy life to the full in just the way that you said that we could. And we ask you, Lord, that you would give us strength and wisdom to walk in obedience to your law, that we would celebrate your law, that we would say that the law of the Lord is good, that the precepts of the Lord are right, that they revive my soul, that they bring good things to me. I pray, Lord, that we would understand that your law is for our rich benefit, and that rather than seeing it as a boundary to which we should edge as close as we can, we would see it as an opportunity to turn and flee as far from sin as we can, to say instead of what is the minimum that I must do, to say where can I begin to do as much as possible to love you and to love my neighbor as I love myself. Father, we ask these things in the name of the one who loved you perfectly and who called us neighbor and placed us above himself. May we love like that. In Jesus' name, amen.